preached about Jesus taking only his precious children home early to be with him, and talked about the will of the Almighty Father who sits on the golden throne in heaven. The congregation swayed and responded with, "Yes, sir, his will be done." Artis answered the preacher along with the rest of them, and he swayed in his seat while he watched his mother scream in agony. But after the service he did not go to the graveyard. While Willie Boy was being lowered into that cold Alabama red clay grave, Artis had hopped a train and was on his way to Newark, New Jersey. He was looking for someone named Mr. Winston Lewis to cut. And the congregation was singing, "Lord, don't move my mountain, just give me the strength to climb." 3 days later, Winston Lewis's heart was found in a paper sack several blocks from his residence. The Weems Weekly, Whistlestop, Alabama's weekly bulletin, February 24, 1944. Icebox Follies, a side splitter. The Dill Pickle Club put on its annual Icebox Follies, and this one was the best yet. Grady Kilgore was cast as Shirley Temple, who sang on the Good Ship Lollipop. I wonder if everyone knew what pretty legs our sheriff has. And my own other half, Wilbur Weems, sang Red Sails in the Sunset. I thought it was good, but then I'm no judge. I hear him every day in the shower. Ha ha. The most hilarious skit was a skit depicting Reverend Scroggins, played by Iggy Threadgood, and Vesta Adcock, played by Pete Tidwell. Opal did all the hair and makeup, and Ninny Threadgood, Biddy Louise Otis, and yours truly made all the costumes. The so-called dangerous animal in the Mutton Jeff skit was none other than Dr. and Mrs. Hadley's bulldog Ring in a gas mask. All the proceeds go to the Christmas Fund to aid all the needy here in Whistlestop and in Troutville. I wish this old war would hurry up and be over with. We sure do miss all our boys. By the way, Wilbur tried to join the Army the other day. Thank God he's too old and has flat feet, or we'd really be in trouble. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, July 28, 1986. Evelyn had gained back all the weight she had lost on her diet, plus 8 more pounds. She was so upset she did not notice that Mrs. Threadgood had her dress on inside out again. They were busy eating a 5-pound box of Divinity Fudge when Mrs. Threadgood said, "I'd kill for a pat of butter. This margarine they serve out here tastes like lard. We had to eat so much of that stuff in the Depression, I don't want to ever have to eat it again. So I just do without, and I have my toast dry with plain apple butter." Come to think of it, Iggy and Ruth bought the cafe in 1929, right in the height of the Depression. But I don't think we ever had margarine there. Leastways, I can't recall if we did. It's odd. Here the whole world is suffering so, but at the cafe, those Depression years come back to me now as the happy times, even though we were all struggling. We were happy and didn't know it. A lot of nights we'd all sit around up at the cafe and just listen to the radio. We'd listen to Fibber McGee and Molly, Amos and Andy, Fred Allen. Oh, I can't remember what all we'd listen to, but they were all good. I can't look at any of these programs they put on the TV today. Just people shooting their guns and shouting insults at each other. Fibber McGee and Molly didn't shout at each other. Amos and Andy used to shout a little, but that was funny. And the colored people on the TV now are not near as sweet as they used to be. Sipsy would have Big George's hide if he talked to Smart Aleck as some of them do. It's not just TV. Mrs. Otis was over at the supermarket one day, and she told this little colored boy that was passing by that she would give him a nickel if he'd lift her groceries in her car for her, and she said that he cut his eyes at her, mean-like, and just walked away. Oh, and it's not just the colored people, either. Back when Mrs. Otis was driving, before she hit that stack of grocery carts, people would run up behind us and blow their horns something awful. And when they passed us, some of them would give us the finger. I never saw such behavior. There's no call to be that ugly. I don't even want to look at the news anymore. Everybody fighting each other. They ought to give those boys some tranquilizers and quiet them down for a while. That's what they gave Mr. Dunaway. I think all the bad news affects people, makes them so mean. So whenever the news comes on, I just cut it off. Lately, for the past 10 years or so, I have just taken to looking at my religious programs. I like the PTL Club. They have a lot of smart men on that program. I send money every once in a while, if I have any. And I listen to Camp Meeting USA from 7 to 8 every night. And I like Oral Roberts and the 700 Club. I like just about all of them, except that woman with the makeup. And she'd be all right if she just didn't cry all the time. Oh, she cries if she's happy, and she cries when she's sad. I'm telling you, she can cry at the drop of a hat. Now there's one that needs her hormones. And I don't like preachers that yell all the time. I don't know why they want to yell when they have a microphone right in their hands. When they get to yelling like that, we just switch them over. And I'll tell you another thing. The funnies in the paper are not funny anymore. I remember when you could always get a laugh out of Gasoline Alley or Wee Willie Winkle. And I loved that little Henry. Oh, the scrapes little Henry could get himself in. I just don't believe people are happy anymore. Not like they used to be. You never see a happy face. At least I don't. I said to Mrs. Otis when Francis carried us out to the mall, I said, "Look at all these people pulling such dried-up, sour little faces, even the youngsters." Evelyn sighed. "I wonder why people have gotten so mean anymore." "Oh, it's all over the world, honey. The end of times are coming. Now, we may go to the year 2000, but I doubt it. You know, I listen to a lot of good preachers, and they're all saying we're in our last time. They say it's in the Bible, in Revelations. Of course, they don't know. Nobody knows but the good Lord. I don't know how long the good Lord is going to let me live, but I'm in my jumping-off years, you know that. That's why I live every day like it could be my last. I want to be ready. And that's why I don't say anything about Mr. Dunaway and Vesta Adcock. We have to live and let live." Evelyn felt she had to ask, "What about them?" "Oh, they think they're in love. That's what they say. Oh, you should have seen them, holding hands and smooching all over the place. Mr. Dunaway's daughter found out about it and came out here and threatened to sue the nursing home, called Mrs. Adcock a hussy." "Oh, no." "Oh, yes, honey. Said she was trying to steal their daddy away from them. It was a big mess. And they took Mr. Dunaway back home. They were afraid he and Mrs. Adcock would try to have relations, I guess. I think that's a dream long dead, myself. Janine said he lost his activities years ago and couldn't possibly harm a fly. So what will a little hugging and kissing hurt? Vesta is heartbroken. No telling what she'll do next. But I'll tell you one thing. They don't give you much slack out here. Evelyn said. I guess not. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, August 1, 1945. Man falls in lacquer. If I hadn't been married to him, I would have never believed it. My other half was out at the railroad yards, hanging out where they've been painting all the troop trains, and he fell into a 250-gallon vat of lacquer. He was able to climb out, but the lacquer dried so fast he was completely encrusted before setting foot on the ground, and we had to get Opal to come over to the house and cut the lacquer out of what's left of his hair. It's a good thing we didn't have any children. I don't have time to worry about any other kids. Does anybody know a good babysitter for a husband? We are all so happy the war is finally over. Bobby Scroggins came home yesterday, and Tommy Glass and Ray Limeway got home last Thursday. Hooray! Nothing but good news. Ninny Threadgood came in and brought me a four-leaf clover. She said she and Albert had found three of them in her front yard. Thanks, Ninny. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, August 15, 1986. Janine, the black nurse who prided herself on being as tough as nails but really wasn't, said she was tired. She was working a double shift today, and she had come in their room to sit down for a minute and have a cigarette. Mrs. Otis was down the hall in her arts and crafts class, so Mrs. Threadgood was happy for the company. "You know that woman I talk to on Sundays?" Janine said. "What woman?" "Evelyn."
"Who?"
"She's that little plump gray-haired woman. Evelyn, Evelyn Couch, Mrs. Couch's daughter-in-law."
"Oh, yes."
"She told me ever since that man called her names at the Piggly Wiggly, she just hates people." I told her, I said, "Oh, honey, it does no good to hate. It'll do nothing but turn your heart into a bitter root. People can't help being what they are any more than a skunk can help being a skunk. Don't you think if they had their choice, they would rather be something else? Sure they would. People are just weak." Evelyn said there are times when she is even beginning to hate her husband. He'll be sitting around doing nothing, looking at his football games or talking on the phone, and she has this terrible desire to hit him in the head with a baseball bat for no reason. Poor little Evelyn. She thinks she's the only person in the world that ever had an ugly thought. I told her her problem is just a natural thing that happens with couples after they've been together so long. I remember when Cleo got his first set of dentures he was so proud of. They'd make this clicking sound every time he'd take a bite of food, and it just grated on my nerves so bad that there'd be some nights I'd just have to get up from the table to keep myself from saying something. And I loved that man better than anything in the world. But you go through a period when you start to get on one another's nerves. And then one day, now I don't know if his teeth stopped clicking on their own or if I just got used to it or what, but it never bothered me another time. You have that kind of thing happen in the best of families. You take Iggy and Ruth. Now, you never saw two people more devoted to each other than they were, but even the two of them went through a period when they had their little problems. Ruth moved in with us once. I never knew what it was about, nor did I ask, because it was none of my business, but I think it was because she didn't like Iggy going over to the river where Eva Bates lives. She said she felt that maybe Eva encouraged Iggy to drink too much for her own good. And it was true. But like I told Evelyn, everybody has their little quirks. Poor little Evelyn, I worry about her. That menopause has hit her with a vengeance.
She said not only does she want to hit Ed in the head, but lately she's been having fantasies in her mind where she dresses up in black clothes and goes out at night and kills all the bad people with a machine gun. Can you imagine? I said, honey, you've been looking at too many TV shows. You just get those thoughts out of your mind right now. Besides, it's not up to us to judge other people. It says right there in the Bible, as plain as the nose on your face, that on Judgment Day, Jesus is going to come down with a host of angels to judge the quick and the dead. Evelyn asked me who the quick were, and do you know, for the life of me, I couldn't tell her. Wagon Wheel Fishing Lodge and River Club, Warrior River, Alabama, June 3, 1946. The blue lights were on, and you could hear the people inside carrying on, and the jukebox blaring all the way across the river. Iggy was sitting right in the middle of it, drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon beer and chasing it with more Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. She was off whiskey for that night because the night before had been enough to last her for a while. Her friend Eva was whooping it up with some country boys that were supposed to be at an Elks Club meeting that night over in Gate City. She passed by Iggy and looked at her. "Good God, girl, what's the matter with you? You look like a lizard with a hangover." Hank Williams was singing his heart out about how he was so lonesome he could die. Iggy said, "Ruth moved out." Eva's mood changed. "What?" "Moved out. Went over to Cleo and Ninny's house." Eva sat down. "Well, good Lord, Iggy, why did she do that?" "She's mad at me." "I figured that. But what did you do?" "I lied to her." "Uh-oh. What did you say?" "I told her I was going to Atlanta to see my sister Leona and John."
"Didn't you go?"
"No."
"Where did you go?"
"Out in the woods."
"With who?"
"By myself. I just wanted to be by myself, that's all."
"Why didn't you tell her?"
"I don't know. I guess I just kind of got mad at having to tell somebody where I am all the time. I don't know. I was beginning to feel kind of trapped, like I needed to get out for a while. So I lied, that's all. What's a big deal? Grady lies to Gladys and Jack lies to Moselle."
"Yeah, but now, honey, you ain't Grady or Jack, and Ruth ain't Gladys or Moselle either." "Oh, Lord, girl, I hate to see this happen. Don't you remember the fits you was having until she came over here?"
"Yeah, but sometimes I just need to take off for a while. I feel like I need my freedom, you know?"
"Of course I do, Iggy, but you gotta look at this thing from her point of view. That girl gave up everything she had to come over here. She left her hometown and all her friends she grew up with, gave up all that just to be here and make a life for you. You and Stump are all she has. You've got all your friends and your family.
Yeah, well, sometimes I think they like her better than they do me."
"You listen, Iggy. I'm going to tell you something. Don't you think she couldn't have anybody that she wanted around here? All she'd have to do is snap her fingers."
"So I'd think long and hard before I'd go flying off."
At that moment, Helen Claypool, a woman of about 50 who'd been hanging around the River Club for years, picking up men and drinking with anything that moved and would buy her drinks, came out of the bathroom so drunk that she had stuffed the back of her dress in her panties and was staggering to her table, where the men were waiting for her. Eva pointed toward her. "Now, there's a woman who got her freedom. Nobody gives a shit where she is, and ain't nobody checking up on her. You can be damn sure of that." Iggy watched Helen with her lipstick smeared and her hair falling in her face, sitting there looking at the men with her boozy eyes, not seeing them. Pretty soon Iggy said, "I gotta go. Gotta think this thing out."
"Yeah. Well, I thought you might."
2 days later, Ruth received a neatly typed note that said, "If you cage a wild thing, you can be sure it will die. But if you let it run free, 9 times out of 10, it will run back home." Ruth called Iggy for the first time in 3 weeks.
"I got your note, and I've been thinking, maybe we should at least talk."
Iggy was thrilled.
"I think that would be great. I'll be right over," she said, and started out the door, planning to swear on a Bible in front of Reverend Scroggins' house, if she had to, that she would never lie to Ruth again. As she turned the corner and saw Cleo and Ninny's house, something Ruth said dawned on her.
What note? She hadn't sent any note.
Birmingham News, October 15, 1947. One-armed quarterback leads team to fifth straight victory. In a 27-20 win over Edgewood, with the score tied 20-20 throughout the fourth quarter, victory for Whistlestop came in the thrilling 43-yard pass made by Whistlestop's one-armed quarterback, Buddy Stump Threadgood, a senior. "Stump is our most valuable player," said Coach Delbert Naves in an interview earlier today. "His winning attitude and team spirit has made the difference. Despite his handicap, he has been able to complete 33 out of 37 attempted passes this year. He is able to take the snap from center and hug the ball to his chest, get the correct grip, and throw the ball in less than 2 seconds. And his speed and accuracy are outstanding. This B-average student is also on the first-string baseball and basketball team. He is the son of Mrs. Ruth Jameson of Whistlestop, and when asked how he became so proficient in sports, he said that his Aunt Iggy, who helped raise him, taught him everything he knows about football." Whistlestop Cafe, Whistlestop, Alabama, October 28, 1947.
Stump had just come in from practice and got himself a Coke. Iggy was behind the counter fixing Smokey Lonesome a second cup of coffee, and she said to him as he passed by, "I want to talk to you, young man."
"Uh-oh," thought Smokey, and buried his head in his pie.
Stump said, "What'd I do? I didn't do anything."
"That's what you think, little fella," she said to Stump, who at the time was 6 feet tall and shaving.
"Let's go in the back room."
He followed her slowly and sat down at the table.
"Where's Mama?"
"She's over at the school in a meeting."
"Now, young man, what did you say to Peggy this afternoon?"
He looked innocent.
"Peggy? Peggy who?"
"You know Peggy who. Peggy Hadley."
"I didn't say anything."
"You didn't say anything?"
"No."
"Then why do you suppose she came in the cafe no more than an hour ago, just crying her eyes out?"
"I don't know. How should I know?"
"Didn't she ask you to go to the Sadie Hawkins dance with her this afternoon?"
"Yeah, I guess she may have. I don't remember."
"And what did you say?"
"Oh, Aunt Iggy, I don't want to go to any dance with her. She's just a kid."
"What did you say?"
"I told her I was busy or something. She's crazy anyhow."
"Mister, I am asking you what you said to that girl."
"Oh, I was just kidding."
"You were just kidding, huh? What you were doing is standing around trying to be a big shot in front of all your friends is what you were doing."
He shifted uncomfortably in his chair. You told her to come back when she had grown some tits and ask you again. Isn't that right?
He didn't answer.
Isn't that right?
Aunt Edgy, I was just kidding.
Well, you're lucky you didn't get your face popped.
Her brother was standing right there with me.
Well, he ought to have his butt kicked, too.
She's just making a big thing out of nothing.
A big thing out of nothing? Do you have any idea how much nerve it took for that poor little thing to ask you to the dance and then for you to say something like that in front of all those boys? Now you listen, buddy boy. Your mother and I didn't raise you to be an ignorant, knothead redneck. How would you feel if somebody talked like that to your mother? What if some girl told you to come back when you grew a penis?
Stump turned red. Don't talk like that, Aunt Edgy.
Yes, I will talk like that. I will not have you acting like white trash. Now, if you don't want to go to the dance, that's one thing. But you are not going to talk to Peggy or any other girl like that. Do you hear me?
Yes'm.
I want you to go down to her house right now and apologize to her. And I don't mean maybe. Do you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
He got up. Sit down. I'm not through with you.
Stump sighed and slumped back down in his chair. What now?
I need to talk to you about something. I want to know what's going on with you and the girls.
Stump looked uncomfortable. What do you mean?
I've never pried into your personal life. You're 17 years old and big enough to be a man. But your mother and I are worried about you.
Why?
We thought you might outgrow this stage you're in, but you're too old to keep hanging around the boys like you do.
What's the matter with my friends?
Nothing. It's just that they're all boys.
So?
There are a whole bunch of girls that are just crazy about you, and you never even give them the time of day.
No answer.
You act like a horse's ass whenever one of them tries to talk to you. I've seen you.
Stump started picking a hole in the checked oilcloth on the table.
Look at me when I talk to you.
Your cousin Buster is already married with a baby on the way, and he's only a year older than you. So?
So you've never even asked a girl out to a picture show, and every time there's a dance over at the school, you decide to go hunting.
I like to hunt.
So do I. But you know, there's more to life than hunting and sports.
Stump sighed again and closed his eyes. I don't like to do anything else.
I bought you that car and had it fixed up for you because I thought you might want to take Peggy somewhere. But all you do is run it up and down the road with the boys.
Why Peggy?
Well, Peggy or anybody. I don't want you winding up all alone like poor Smokey in there.
Smokey's all right.
I know he's all right, but he'd be a whole lot better if he had a wife and a family. What's going to happen to you if something happens to me or your mother?
I'll get by. I'm not stupid.
I know you'd get by, but I'd like to think you'd have somebody to love and take care of you. Before you know it, all the best girls are going to be taken. And what's the matter with Peggy?
She's all right.
I know you like her. You used to send her valentines before you got to be so high and mighty.
No answer.
Well, is there anybody else you like?
No.
Why not?
Stump began to squirm and yelled, I just don't, that's all. Now leave me alone.
Listen, bub. Iggy said. You may be a big deal on that football field, but I changed your diapers, and I'll knock you to hell and back. Now, what is it?
Stump didn't answer.
What is it, son?
I don't know what you're talking about. I gotta go.
Sit down. You don't have to go anywhere.
He sighed and sat back down.
Iggy quietly asked, Stump, don't you like girls?
Stump looked away.
Yeah, I like 'em all right.
Then why don't you go out with them?
Well, I'm not weird or anything, if that's what you're worried about. It's just...
Stump was wiping his sweaty palm on his khaki pants.
Come on, Stump, tell me what it is, son. You and I have always been able to talk things out.
I know that. I just don't want to talk to anybody about this.
I know you don't, but I want you to. Now what is it?
Well, it's just that... Oh, Jesus.
Then he mumbled,
It's just that... What if one of them ever wanted to do it?
You mean wanted to have sex?
Stump nodded and looked at the floor.
Iggy said, Well, then I'd consider myself a lucky boy, wouldn't you? I think it would be a compliment.
Stump wiped the perspiration off his upper lip.
Son, are you having some kind of physical trouble? You know, getting yourself up? Because if you are, we can take you to the doctor and have you checked out.
Stump shook his head. No, it's not that. Nothing's the matter with me. I've done it 1,000 times.
Iggy was amazed at the number, but remained calm and said, Well, then, at least we know you're all right.
Yeah, I'm all right. It's just that, well, I haven't done it with anybody. You know, I've just done it by myself.
That's not gonna hurt you. But don't you think you should try it out with some girl? I can't believe you haven't had the chance, a good-looking boy like you.
Yeah, I had the chance. It's not that, it's just...
Iggy heard his voice crack.
It's just...
Just what, son? All of a sudden he couldn't stop the hot tears from running down his face. He looked up at her.
It's just that... I'm scared, Aunt Iggy. I'm just plain scared.
The one thing Iggy had never suspected was that Stump, who had been so brave all his life, could be scared of anything. What are you afraid of, son?
Well, I'm kinda afraid I'll fall on her or lose my balance because of my arm and... Maybe I just won't know how to do it right. You know, I might hurt her or something. I don't know.
He was avoiding her eyes. Stump, look at me. What are you really afraid of?
I told you.
You're afraid some girl might laugh, aren't you? Finally, after a moment, he blurted out,
Yes. I guess that's it.
And he put his hand over his face, ashamed to be crying. At that moment, Iggy's heart went out to him, and she did something she very rarely did. She got up and put her arms around him and rocked him like a baby.
Oh, honey, don't you cry. Everything's gonna be all right, Angel. Nothing's gonna happen to you. And Iggy's not gonna let... Anything bad ever happen? No, I'm not. Have I ever let you down?
No, ma'am.
Nothing bad's gonna happen to my boy. I won't have it.
The whole time she was rocking Stump back and forth, she was feeling helpless and was trying to think if she knew someone who might be able to help him. Early Saturday morning, Itchy drove Stump over to the river as she had so many years ago, and through the white wagon wheel gate and up to a cabin with a screened-in porch, and let him out. The door of the cabin opened, and a freshly bathed, powdered, and perfumed woman with rust-colored hair and apple-green eyes said, "Come on in, sugar," as Iggy drove away. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, October 30th, 1947. Stump Threadgood Makes Good. Stump Threadgood, son of Iggy Threadgood and Ruth Jamison, got a big write-up in the Birmingham News. Congratulations. We're all mighty proud of him. But don't go in the cafe unless you're willing to spend an hour having Iggy tell you all about the game. Never saw a prouder parent. And after the game, the whole team and the band and the cheerleaders were treated to free hamburgers at the cafe. My other half has no fashion sense. I came home the other afternoon looking so smart in my new snood that I got over at Opal's beauty shop, and he said my snood looked like a goat's udder with a fly net on it. Then, on our anniversary, he carries me over to Birmingham to a spaghetti restaurant when he knows I'm on a diet. Men can't live with them and can't live without them. By the way, we were sorry to hear about Artis O'Peavy's bad luck. Dot Weems.
Slagtown, Alabama, October 17, 1949. Artis O'Peavy had been staying with his second wife, the former Miss Madeline Poole, who was employed as a first-class domestic. She worked for a family on the exclusive Highland Avenue. They were living at her house at number 6 Tintop Alley over on the south side of town. Tintop Alley was nothing more than six rows of wooden shack houses with tin roofs and dirt yards, most of which had been decorated with washtubs planted with colorful flowers to offset the drab gray wood of the shacks. It was a step up from their last address. That had been the old servants' quarters in the back of a house whose address was simply Number 2 Alley G. Artis found the neighborhood extremely pleasant. One block away was Magnolia Point, where he could hang out in front of stores and visit with other husbands of domestics. In early evenings after a supper, usually of white folks' leftovers, they would all sit on the porches, and many a night one family would start to sing, and one by one the others would join in. Recreation was plentiful because the walls were so thin that you could enjoy your neighbor's radio or phonograph along with them. When Bessie Smith sang on somebody's Victrola, "I Ain't Got Nobody," everybody in Tintop Alley felt sorry for her. The area was certainly not lacking in other social activities, and Artis was invited to all of them. He was the most popular man in the alley, with men and women alike. Every night there would be at least one or two chitlin fryings or barbecuing, or if the weather was bad, you could just sit under the yellow light on your front porch and enjoy the sound of the rain hitting the tin roofs. This fall afternoon, Artis had been sitting on the porch watching a thin trail of blue smoke rise up from his cigarette, happy because Joe Lewis was the champion of the world, and the Birmingham Black Barons baseball team had won all their games that year. Just then, a skinny, mangy yellow dog came loping around the alley, scrounging for something to eat. He belonged to After John, a friend of Artis's, named such because he had been born after his brother John. The dog wig-wagged his way up the porch steps to Artis and got his daily pat on the head. "I ain't got nothing for you today, boy." The yellow dog was mildly disappointed and wandered off in search of leftover cornbread or even a few greens.
The depression had never ended here, and dogs were in it too, for better or for worse, and most times for the worse. Artis saw the dog catcher's truck drive up, and the man in the white uniform got out with his net. The back was already loaded with yelping dogs, unfortunate enough to have been caught that afternoon. The man who got out whistled for the yellow dog who was up the street. Here, boy, come on, boy. The friendly, unsuspecting dog ran over to him, and in a second was in the net, flipped over on his back, and was being carried to the truck. Artis came off the porch.
Hey, whoa, mister, that dog belongs to somebody.
The man stopped.
Is he yours? No, he ain't mine. He belonged after John, so you can't be carrying him off, no sir.
I don't care who it belongs to, it don't have a license, and we're taking him in.
The other man in the truck got out and just stood there. Artis began to plead, because he knew that once that dog got down to the city pound, there wasn't a chance in hell of ever getting him back, particularly if you were black.
Please, mister, let me go and call him. He works over at Five Points for Mr. Fred Jones making ice cream. Just let me call him.
Do you have a phone?
No, sir, but I can run up to the grocery store. Won't take but a minute.
Artis pleaded harder with the man.
Oh, please, sir. After John is just a simple-minded boy no woman would marry, and that dog is all he's got. I don't know what he'd do if anything happened to that dog of his. He's liable to kill himself.
The two men looked at each other, and the larger one said,
"Okay, but if you ain't back in 5 minutes, we're leaving. You hear me?"
Artis started moving.
"Yes, sir. I'll be right back."
As he ran, he realized that he didn't have a nickel and prayed that Mr. Leo, the Italian man that ran the grocery store, would loan him one. He ran in the store out of breath and saw Mr. Leo.
Mr. Leo, I gots to have a nickel. They're gonna carry after John's dog off, and they's waiting for me. Please, Mr. Leo.
Mr. Leo, who hadn't understood a word that Artis had said, made him calm down and explained to him all over again. But by the time he got his nickel, there was a white boy on the phone. Artis was sweating, moving from one foot to another, knowing he couldn't make that fella get off that phone. 1 minute. 2. Artis moaned.
Oh, Lord.
Finally, Mr. Leo passed by and knocked on the glass booth.
Get off!
The young man begrudgingly said goodbye to his party for the next 60 seconds and hung up. After he left, Artis jumped in the booth and realized he did not know the number. His hands were wet and shaking as he searched through the telephone directory hanging from a small chain.
Jones. Jones. Oh, Lord. Jones. Jones. 4 pages full. Fred B. Oh, man, that's his residence.
He had to start all over in the yellow pages.
What do I look under? Ice cream? Drugstore?
And he couldn't find it. He dialed information.
Information? A crisp white voice answered. Yes, please. May I help you?
Yes, ma'am. I's looking for the number of Fred B. Jones.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that name, please?
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Fred Jones in 5 Points.
His heart was pounding.
I have about 50 Fred Joneses, sir. Do you have a street address?
No, ma'am, but he's over in 5 Points.
I have 3 Fred Joneses in the 5 Points area. Would you like all 3 numbers?
Yes, ma'am.
He searched his pockets for a pencil, and she started.
Mr. Fred Jones, 18 South, 68799. And Mr. Fred Jones, 141 Magnolia Point, 68745.
and Fred C. Jones, 15th Street. That number is 68721.
He never found a pencil, and the operator hung up. Back to the book. He could hardly breathe. The sweat was running down his eyes, blurring his vision. Drugstore, pharmacy, ice cream, food, catering. That's it. Here it was, Fred B. Jones Catering, 68715.
He mashed the nickel in the slot and dialed the number. Busy. Tried again. Busy. Busy.
Oh, Lord.
After trying 8 times, Artis didn't know what to do, so he just ran back to the men. He turned the corner, and thank God they were still there, leaning up against the truck. They had the dog tied to the door handle with a rope.
"You get him?" the big one asked.
"No, sir," he said, gasping. "I wasn't able to reach him, but if you could just ride me over to 5 Points, I could get him."
"No, we're not gonna do that. We already wasted enough time with you, boy."
And he began to untie the dog and put him in the back. Artis was desperate.
"No, sir, I just can't let you do it."
He reached in his pocket, and before either one of the men knew what had happened, he had sliced the rope holding the dog in half with the 4-inch switchblade and yelled, "Scat!" Artis turned around and watched the grateful dog scamper around the corner, and was smiling when the blackjack hit him behind his left ear. 10 years for the attempted murder of a city official with a deadly weapon. It would have been 30 if those 2 men had been white. Birmingham, Alabama, September 1st, 1986. Ed Couch came home Thursday night and said that he was having trouble with a woman down at the office who was a real ball breaker, and that none of the men wanted to work with her because of it. The next day, Evelyn went out to the mall to shop for a bed jacket for Big Mama, and while she was having lunch at the Pioneer Cafeteria, a thought popped into her head unannounced. What is a ball breaker? She'd heard Ed use that term a lot, along with, "She's out to get my balls," and, "I had to hold on to my balls for dear life." Why was Ed so scared that someone was out to get his balls? What were they, anyway? Just little pouches that carried sperm. But the way men carried on about them, you'd think they were the most important thing in the world. My God, Ed had just about died when one of their sons hadn't dropped properly. The doctor said that it wouldn't affect his ability to have children, but Ed had acted like it was a tragedy and wanted to send him to a psychiatrist so he wouldn't feel less of a man. She remembered thinking at the time, how silly. Her breasts had never developed, and nobody ever sent her for help. But Ed had won out because he told her she didn't understand about being a man and what it meant. Ed had even pitched a fit when she wanted to have their cat Valentine, who had impregnated the thoroughbred Siamese cat across the street, fixed. He said, "If you're gonna cut his balls off, you might as well go on and put him to sleep." No doubt about it, he was peculiar where balls were concerned. She remembered how Ed had once complimented that same woman at the office when she had stood up to the boss. He had bragged on her, saying what a ballsy dame she was. But now that she thought about it, she wondered, what did that woman's strength have to do with Ed's anatomy? He hadn't said, "Boy, she's got some ovaries." He had definitely said what balls she had. Ovaries have eggs in them, she thought. Shouldn't they be as important as sperm? And when had that woman stepped over the line of having just enough balls to having too much? That poor woman. She would have to spend her whole life balancing imaginary balls if she wanted to get along. Balance was everything.
But what about size, she wondered. She never heard Ed mention size before. It was the other thing, size, they were so concerned about, so she guessed it didn't matter all that much. All that mattered in this world was the fact that you had balls. Then, all at once, the simple and pure truth of that conclusion hit her. She felt as if someone had run a pencil up her spine and dotted an I on her head. She sat up straight in her chair, shocked that she, Evelyn Couch of Birmingham, Alabama, had stumbled on the answer. She suddenly knew what Edison must have felt like when he discovered electricity. Of course, that was it. Having balls was the most important thing in this world. No wonder she had always felt like a car in traffic without a horn. It was true. Those two little balls opened the door to everything. They were the credit card she needed to get ahead, to be listened to be taken seriously. No wonder Ed had wanted a boy. Then another truth occurred to her, another sad, irrevocable truth. She had no balls, and never would or could have balls. She was doomed, ball-less forever. Unless, she thought, if maybe the balls in your immediate family counted. There were four in hers, Ed's and Tommy's. No, wait, six if she counted the cat. No, wait just another minute. If Ed loved her so much, why couldn't he give her one of his? A ball transplant, that's right. Or maybe she could get two from an anonymous donor. That's it. She'd buy some off a dead man, and she could put them in a box and take them to important meetings and bang them on the table to get her way. Maybe she'd buy four. No wonder Christianity had been such a big hit. Think of Jesus and the apostles. And if you counted John the Baptist, why, that was 14 pairs and 28 singles right there. Oh! It was all so simple to her now. How had she been so blind and not seen it before? Yes, by heavens, she'd done it. She'd hit upon the secret that women had been searching for through the centuries. This was the answer. Hadn't Lucille Ball been the biggest star on television? She banged her iced tea on the table in triumph and shouted, "Yes! That's it!" Everyone in the cafeteria turned and looked at her. Evelyn quietly finished her lunch and thought, "Lucille Ball? Ed might be right. I probably am going crazy." The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, June 10, 1948. Benefit for New Balls. The Dill Pickle Club will hold a womanless wedding to benefit the high school so they can get a new set of balls for the football, basketball, and baseball teams this year. This should be quite an evening with our own Sheriff Grady Kilgore as the lovely bride and Iggy as the groom. Julian Threadgood, Jack Butts, Harold Vick, Pete Tidwell, and Charlie Fowler will be the bridesmaids. This affair will be at the high school on June 14th at 7 o'clock. Admission is 20 cents for adults and 5 cents for children. Essie Rue Limeway will play the organ for the wedding. Come one, come all. I intend to be there, as my other half, Wilbur, will be the flower girl. My other half and I went to the picture show and saw the Gracie Allen murder mystery. It was funny, but go before the prices change at 7. By the way, Reverend Scroggins said someone put his lawn furniture on top of his house. Dot Weems. Kilby Prison, Atmore, Alabama, July 11, 1948. Artis O. Peavy had been sent down to Kilby Prison, better known as the Murder Farm, for pulling a knife on those two dog catchers.
and it had taken Itchy and Grady 6 months of trying before they could get him out. On the way down, Grady said to Itchy, "It's a damn good thing he's coming out now. He might not have lasted in that place for another month." Grady knew what he was talking about, having once been a guard there. "Hell, if the guards don't get him, then the other niggers will. I've seen decent men turn into animals inside. Men with a wife and children at home will turn around and kill one another over some gal boy." Every night in the cell blocks was bad, but whenever there was a full moon, look out. They all go crazy and stick each other. We'd go in the next morning and there'd be about 25 stiffs we'd have to bring out. And after a while down there, the only difference between the men and the guards is the gun. Most of those guards are pretty simple-minded old boys. They'll go to a picture show and see Tom Mix or Hoot Gibson, and then they come back and ride around the farm pulling their guns, trying to be cowboys. Sometimes they get meaner than the prisoners. That's why I quit. I've seen men that would beat a nigger to death just to have something to do. I'm telling you, that place gets to you after a while. And I hear now that they've got those Scottsboro boys down here. Things is worse than ever. Now Itchy was really worried, and she wished he would drive faster. When they turned in the gate that led down the road to the main building, they saw hundreds of prisoners in coarse-striped uniforms out in the yard digging or hoeing, and they saw the guards, just like Grady had said, showing off as the car passed by, running their horses in circles and peering at the car as it drove by. Itchy thought that most of them did look a little retarded, so when they brought Artis out, she was relieved to see that he was still alive and well. Although his clothes were wrinkled, his hair was nappy. Artis was never so happy to see anybody in his whole life. The scars on his back from the whip didn't show, and they could not see the lumps on his head. He grinned from ear to ear as they walked out to the car. He was going home. On the way back, Grady said, "Now, Artis, I'm in charge of you, so don't be going and getting in any more trouble, you hear?"
"No, sir. I don't ever want to go back to that place. No, sir."
Grady looked at him in the rearview mirror.
"Pretty rough in there, huh?"
Artis laughed.
"Yes, sir, it'd be pretty rough, all right. Yes, sir, pretty rough."
When they first caught sight of the steel mills in Birmingham about 4 hours later, Artis became so excited he was like a child and wanted to get out of the car. Itchy tried to get him to come home to Whistle Stop first. "Your mama and daddy and Sipsy are all waiting to see you." But he pleaded to get out in Birmingham for just a few hours. So they drove him over to 8th Avenue North, where he wanted to be let out. Itchy said, "Please try and get on home soon, 'cause they really want to see you. Promise?" Artis said,
"Yes, ma'am, I promise,"
and ran down the street laughing, so happy to be back where he belonged. About a week later, he showed up at the cafe, his hair smooth as glass, looking spectacular in his brand-new Revel hat designed in Harlem with the extra-wide brim, a gift from Madeline, happy to have him home. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, September 7, 1986. This week, for Evelyn and Ninny, the bill of fare was corn curls and cokes and homemade brownies. "Honey, you should have been out here this morning. You missed a show. We were all having our breakfast, and we looked up, and there was Vesta Adcock with a bran muffin on her head doing a hula dance right in front of us in the dining room. It was a sight. Poor old Mr. Dunaway got so excited they had to give him his pill and take him to his room. Janine, that little colored nurse, made her sit down and eat her muffin.
They want us to have one of those every day, so we won't get constipated. When you get up in years, your digestive system goes off. She leaned over and whispered, "Some of these old people out here pass gas and